Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 179, featuring Ian Spriggs. And I need to give you guys a little bit of context here because Ian was a speaker, was an amazing speaker at our event in Sofia called Total Chaos. And this was only the second time that I've actually met Ian in person. The first time was at THU last year. But I've known him and we have communicated for a long time on the internet and all those other things. He is an incredible artist that I find to be absolutely fascinating, especially in the world of portraiture and digital humans. What he does is he makes portraits of his friends and sometimes commissions. Actually, now he's doing a lot of commissions of people that are just absolutely breathtaking. He is heavily inspired by old portraitures from paintings. Specifically, he loves Rembrandt and a lot of the Dutch masters and people from that era. And he mimics this in a CG to complete photorealism. Takes his time. He hand models everything. His talk is absolutely incredible, and I love his work. He is also a member of the Digital Human League, which is a group that I started, which is focused on creating the WikiHuman project. And a lot of you guys may know a little bit about that. You guys know I have a passion for digital humans and all the things they do, but his perspective from the art history point of view, as well as the fact that he just does everything by hand, is really, really enlightening. And so I really love having him as part of my group, and he's a great opinion about it. In fact, on the new WikiHuman that we're doing with Digital Mike, he's actually contributed some of his own work to that project as well. So really, really exciting to have him there. Now, again, what I should say about this podcast is that this was one of the last people to speak at Total Chaos. And he came to do the podcast right after he finished his talk. And this was the last podcast that I did there. So he and I were both very tired from the event. And we sort of just jumped right into it and started talking about things that interest us. So if you don't know who Ian Spriggs is or you don't know much of his work, I'd highly recommend you go check out some of his work first so that you have an idea of what we're talking about. So you can go to his site, iansprigs.com, which is iansprigs.com, and go check out his work. And we'll also put a few of his portraits up on the actual podcast page so you guys can check that out. But it really would give some context to what this is about. And so it's really, really, really important and really great. And he is going to actually be another speaker at THU again this year. So they made quite an impression at THU. It was awesome. And that was the first time he ever spoke publicly last year. So really, really excited to have that. Okay, a few announcements before we move on. Let's see. Oh, yes. V-Ray Next for Maya Beta is out. And if you would like to know more about it and try some of the awesome new features, we would love for you to be able to do that. So just go to chaosgroup.com and register to be on the beta. I think you get it for as long as the beta is free. I don't think you need a license. I think you can just get it. But go ahead and try it. You may need a current license and just get it for free without an upgrade. But anyway, whatever. Just go ahead and try it. Give us notes. That's the most important thing. If you're part of a beta, what we really appreciate is letting us know what doesn't work, what works, what you would like, how to fix things. That's what a beta is for. And that's what makes V-Ray so great, is the fact that we actually get great, great feedback from our users. And we need that from you guys as well. So please let us know. Just go check that out. And that's about it. The only other thing I'd like to say is if you guys are coming to SIGGRAPH, I'd love to know more about what you guys are looking forward to. We are going to be planning 2 days of V-Ray Days talks over there. So we'll be planning that, and that will be coming up soon. So just go to chaosgroup.com and check out the news on that area, and we'd love to see it. All right, guys, thank you so much. Let's listen to this awesome podcast with someone who I am now considering a good friend of mine, Ian Spriggs.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays In high dynamic range, we know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Feel good about your talk?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I felt like my THU talk was a bit better.
But really?
I feel like this one went pretty good. Like, not as good, but pretty good.
I think this one was better.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. Well, they were different, which was also kind of cool.
Yeah, some different points in there.
And I thought this one was richer. It's definitely evolution.
Yeah, a little bit. I felt like I kind of rushed the points. Like, it was a smoother getting to the points.
Right.
I didn't hesitate as much.
I think there was some, first of all, let's go back and let's see. When you did the THU talk, that was your first time.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, so nervous for that one, but I felt much better.
There was 700 people in that room.
Yeah.
And I think you did just fine.
It's true. I was kind of blind to like the people in the back.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the close up and then all these people walked in and I was like, I didn't even see them walk in.
What's it like to give a talk like that?
I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to explain.
Isn't it that you, like, for example, not just actually giving the talk, but preparing for that talk, right? You have to think about a lot of history and think about a lot of these things.
Yeah, it's true. Like every time I do my portraits, it's like I think about these ideas. And yeah. It's like the stuff I think doing portraiture is like, it's really important because portraiture has been done for like hundreds of years. And now it's like, in 100 years from now, they're going to look back and be like, who are these people at this time? And it's like doing these portraits for this.
Right.
That's kind of important. So I think about those ideas when I'm doing the work. So right. It's just like, for me, like doing a talk like this is just kind of like just talking about I just have to finalize the idea just a little bit more than just what's in my head.
Yeah. When I first saw your work, it was the first time I started to realize that when people keep talking about digital humans, they keep worrying about the uncanny valley. They keep worrying about it and they only think of it in the context of digital humans.
Yeah.
And I realized that the uncanny valley has been a problem forever.
It's true.
Before computers, like, you know, you put that portrait of the Mona Lisa up, for example, there's a good argument that she could be kind of in the uncanny valley.
Yeah, it's true. Well, yeah, she kind of is. But
she kind of is, right?
But there's like that aesthetics. It's kind of like, there's that, well, I was talking about my talk, there's that representational and then there's like that romantic side of things.
Right.
So that she gets past that uncanny valley because she is more on the romantic side of things. There's more of like a artistic beauty to it.
So let's go through some of those points a little bit that you brought up. There's some really good ideas about what you're doing. So the first thing that people should realize is, you know, actually we did it. We've been on the podcast before, but it was only for like a little bit.
Yeah,
you were on for the THU stuff. So I thought a longer form podcast would be better. When you went to art school, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I almost failed art school.
You almost failed art school.
Yeah.
And you did mention in your THU talk, you talk about that struggle in art school.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. Why was that so hard?
Because I was like, when I first got in, I was representational was my, what I wanted to do. I liked drawing people, like drawing like what I saw.
Right.
And it's like, for them, it was more about content.
Right.
And so, and representational was not content whatsoever. So it's like, they kind of forced me to be more, push more into that direction of like how to express emotion, how to just express thoughts.
Right.
Without that representational stuff. And I kind of resisted for a while.
Uh-huh.
And then I just got like a couple letters sent to me saying I'm failing unless I change my ways. So
wow.
I was like, all right, well, I'll just do a couple projects just to make them happy.
Right.
So I just did that. And they're like, all right, you're just best.
Wow. But it's funny because you meant do what you just said is like, you're not trying to show emotion, but somehow your portraits are extremely representational, but yet express huge amounts of emotion to it.
Yeah.
Do you think you learned that from school or do you think you had it the whole time and the people in art school didn't see it?
I think school kind of taught me how to like It taught me how to, like, there is the emotional side. Like, it's not like I didn't get anything out of art school. Like, right. I just didn't learn how to do like the emotional side of work and the content. But then it's like, I stuck with the representational stuff. Like, that's what I loved. And I just kind of put a little bit of the two together.
Right.
And hopefully that's kind of what my work is now.
And your work is also very much referential of, you know, like the Dutch masters and Rembrandt and people like that, or Vermeer. Do you think that referencing art that is significant from a different period, right? Do you think that some people in the art school would say, well, you're just referencing art from the old school as opposed to making making your own evolutionary art?
Yeah, that's a good point. I try and like to let it inspire me. Like, they've done techniques and tricks and they've done some stuff. For me, it was like, that was the peak of art. And I was like, I just want to kind of somehow bring it back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the aesthetically, they've done stuff which is absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if I can bring some of those techniques, what they've done aesthetically as well, to my work,
right,
it's just going to make people love it a little bit more, hopefully.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to, but yeah, it's not, I don't know. I can see how some people might be a step back, but it's like,
I'm not saying that. I actually have a point that's going to be compliment you.
Oh, no, no.
I'm not saying you're taking a step back. I think people may see that, but you've studied portraiture for a long time and you know very specifically, and you mentioned it in your talk, that portraiture was commissioned by Long, right?
Yeah.
And the reason it was commissioned is that you wanted to be preserved historically in some way, right?
Yeah,
wanted a painting of yourself on the wall so that you could show how rich you were, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
And then when cameras came along...
the need
for photorealism in portraiture sort of vanished because you can get it with a camera.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but it's like, it's funny because like as soon as like those paintings would take a long time to do,
yeah,
and photography would be a quick thing,
mm-hmm,
and now it's almost become like so quick that now it's almost like becoming a long version again. Like a digital portrait takes a long time, so people are kind of appreciating it a little bit more. So it's almost going back to what the paintings were.
Oh yeah, I mean your portraits take how long does the average portrait for you take?
It's like 2 to 3 months.
Two to three months.
It's my personal time.
Well, yeah.
But yeah.
But you take your time doing it, right? It's not a quick process.
Yeah, yeah. I would keep on going until I feel like it's done.
Right.
There's no rush.
But one of the things I think is really important. Because I've actually given talks on digital humans, as you know, and I've since evolved my talk, and I include your work as part of my talk, which is really kind of funny because you include part of my talk in your talk. But I include it because specifically as that idea, when you start with the Rembrandt paintings and you start with these paintings of rich queens and kings and noble people and rich people, sort of representing them and how that camera came along and sort of destroyed that. And so now people were represented in a more abstract way, through painting. And nowadays people are obsessed with portraiture, especially self-portraiture.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's true.
Which is with their cameras. They're taking pictures of themselves and putting it up on Instagram all the time, every time.
Whatever technology is at that time, people always, the first thing they do is do like a selfie or whatever. It's like, if you have a paintbrush and a canvas, the first thing they'll do is do people.
Right.
First thing you do with a camera, take photo, portraits or photo, like people's faces.
Right.
Now it's like the cell phone camera, selfies.
Right.
Now it's digital work. So it's now it's digital, like humans.
Right.
It's like people always wanted to represent people.
Why do they want to do that?
Well, I think it's just like, I don't know. It's like, it's our history. It's like, it's who we are as a race. It's like, we always want to understand who we are throughout. Like, we want to always put our foot into the history books in a way, I guess.
Yeah. Do you think that people really think that if they put their portrait on Instagram, they're in the history books?
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
I think they do it, though, because they want to get some recognition, though.
They do want recognition.
So in a way, it's like it might not be a history book, but it might be a second history book.
Right.
You know what I mean? It might just be a little amount of like a couple likes.
Right.
So basically, it's like a mini version of a history book.
Right. And it's recognition.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you... What about... There's a little... When you're representing someone, like let's say your friend Tony, right? You mentioned the story about how you're trying to capture him in a specific way.
Yeah.
And he kind of had the same pose in the end, but a completely different expression than what you intended.
Yeah.
So do you feel that when you were asking your subjects to actually, you know, a pose for you for your reference and all your other stuff, do you try to sort of... How do you balance it? Because you usually start with a reference of where you're going, and how do you get them to actually be themselves?
Yeah, usually like right off the bat, I try to control it. Yeah, and it never works at all. Like I never get good photos from that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, so from now, like because I take photos, I take two shoots basically. So
explain that process if you can, just sort of so that people know a little bit your technique.
So I'll take photos from like every single angle. So I can actually model it from and texture from that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have like a 360 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the same process as how scans work, but I'll just do it manually.
Right.
So I'll take photos for that. And then I'll take photos of like different lighting situations, different poses, and I'll try different expressions and just like the all that side of things. So it's the two shoots.
Mm-hmm.
Now I've learned if I do the model shoot first from the 360 degrees, it relaxes the people a little bit more, gets them more like comfortable with the camera.
Right.
And then I move on to like the different poses and different lighting. And then I try to just have a conversation with them and try to get them to relax it a little bit.
Right.
But yeah, the more I control it, the worse it gets.
Yeah. I know you were teaching, but do you ever see the Norman Seeff's work or see any of his stuff?
No, I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Okay. I'll have to show him to you because he's amazing. He's a photographer and he's photographed some of the most famous people in the world, right? And he does these incredible ones, like the Steve Jobs one, like of him standing like this.
Yeah, I've seen that
He one. Photographed that.
Okay.
Like he's done like the Rolling Stones and Tina Turner. All of them.
I've probably seen it. Yeah, I've seen
it. You've seen all of his portraits before. But he talks about his process specifically of how he gets his subjects to be there. And it's a photo shoot is like a 3 to 4 hour session. And it's just like conversations and conversation. He says, I'm a terrible photographer, but I can find the moments and get I'm not worried about the technology, right? And he's not worried about the lighting too much, even though they're perfect photographs, but he's like, it's just mostly about finding those moments.
I take like at least 2 hours of my photo shoots usually.
Right.
But yeah, I think 4 hours might be a bit better.
But I think that's a good point, right? You gotta find a way to relax people.
Yeah. I think after like 4 hours, there's no way you can still be stressed.
No.
Your body would just be like, I'm just tired.
You're just tired.
And you just relax automatically maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not a photographer at all. I only started taking photos like since I started doing my portraits.
Right.
I'm like the worst cameraman possible, I think. But it doesn't really matter.
At least you get focused though, right? You can get focused.
Sometimes. Not all the time. But the thing is, it doesn't really matter though, because I can just change it digitally.
Right.
Like if like some people would be like, oh, I'm wearing these shoes. I'm like, that's okay. I'll just put different shoes on you.
Right.
And they're like, oh yeah, of course. And like, I don't like my hair this way. I'm like, well, it's fine. I'll just not do it like that. I'll change it.
Right.
Like you can do anything you want. It's digital.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned something. Another thing you mentioned was with the portrait of your, I guess your sister-in-law, where you were talking about, because you mentioned it briefly, but I want to go in more depth of the, someone's more flattering or more representational. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk about that philosophy that you had there.
I think there's two ways to go with portraits. There's the representational way, which is a true, accurate representation of what they look like in reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not romanticizing anything. And then there's the other direction where you can romanticize them and make them look better than they really are,
mm-hmm.
make them look more beautiful. It's more aesthetically pleasing, but then it goes, the further you go that direction, it's kind of like that's your artistic style. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you have an artistic style, that's not true representation of reality.
Right.
So in doing a portrait, you want it to still be true to the subject and true to their likeness and true to who they are.
Right.
But then you also mixed that with, because you still want it to be a good painting, you still want people to like it and like connect with it. So you kind of like, there's a combination of both those things together.
Okay. And what about your sister-in-law? So what was the story with her portrait?
Yeah, I showed it to her and she was just looked at it. And I was like, a couple of minutes went by and she didn't actually say anything. Say anything. And I was like, does she like it or does she not like it?
Yeah.
And I think it was the fact that she thought that she looked better than that. Like, I might have maybe not look as good, or maybe
she looked pretty good.
Yeah, but
she's a good looking woman.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I thought it was a beautiful picture. I thought I did a good job.
Yeah.
But then it's like, yeah, I wasn't sure what she was actually thinking of it. So I don't know.
But she never told you?
No, not really, no.
Do you think it's because she was a little freaked out?
Maybe it was just seeing herself. Maybe she was like, oh my God, that looks so much like me. And then just didn't like it because of that reason.
Right.
I don't know if it was because it represented her perfectly or if I didn't make it aesthetically better, or I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I'd react if I saw one of your portraits of someone like me. I think I'd be a little, I don't know how I'd react.
My mom was a little bit upset.
Do you think it's true for women more than men?
Not necessarily, I know. Like the portrait of Heidi, she loved it.
Right, okay. Yeah,
so.
But you've never got a man say, oh, I don't know about that. Oh, maybe you don't.
Not so much, no, actually.
Right.
Yeah, I think most of the guys I've done, they seem to like it.
Right.
Yeah. The most recent one, of Portrait of Cassidy.
Yeah.
It was like, there was some like imperfections where I was wondering if I should actually take them out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like some freckles or some like some frizzy hair. And mm-hmm. I was like, should I just take these out and just make it not look exactly the same? But I was like, it adds personality. It adds character.
Absolutely.
So I'm like, there's no way I can take that out. Even if she doesn't like it, it's kind of like, well, it's too bad. But I like it because it makes you who you are.
Yeah. I think there's imperfections are actually are quite pleasing sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise,
you look like a mannequin if you're perfectly clean and smooth.
Yeah. There's an actor, a male actor. I'm not going to name him specifically because we were working on it as a digital human and we scanned him, like accurately scanned him. And, you know, you always look at him like, hey, he's a good looking guy, you know, whatever. Women love him. He's like very attractive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at him and it's like, he is so disproportionate. Like his left eye and his right eye are like a half eye, like higher than the other eye. This very disproportionate person.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized like, it's amazing when you realize like, that's probably why he's attractive because he's got an unusual face, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I think that the character comes out
yeah,
in things. You
absolutely.
Know? When you have some slight imperfections and you have things of that nature, and people like look more attractive.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, definitely all of those imperfections. But like most artists, they try to get that perfection.
Yeah.
And it's like they go that direction because they think it's the right direction, but it's kind of the wrong direction.
Right. And what about the idea you mentioned, you know, you see some people, they used to, they don't do as much anymore. And I think it's because of, honestly, work like yours that has changed it. But they used to represent digital humans and they would always put them in a T-pose, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they'll never be realistic if they're in a T-pose.
Right. They're not.
If you saw a human being stood in the street in a T-pose, you'd be like, that guy's in the Uncanny Valley. Even though he's a real human being.
Yep. Yeah, I have kind of funny side story. I was doing this car commercial and... There was live shots of people that were in the car driving, and then we would have pullouts and it'd be a CG car with the people driving by. So I had to put like, there's just little small avatar silhouettes of these people in there. And I was going to do it real quick and dirty because we were going to tint the glasses anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the people that were in the car and I had them all stand in a T-pose so I could just sit there and just like slap on textures and a little bit of color on a digital representation. So it'd just be, you know, catch a little bit of something. It was so slight. But there was this one girl who was a model who was, you know, one of the people, she just could not stand in a T-pose because she constantly had to like move her hips to the side a little bit, like powder face. Well, no, it's because she was used to being a model where she never looks at the camera straight. Always had to stand there. So sure, her arms were out, but she was standing three quarters and looking at me with her head cocked. It's like, that's no, like a scarecrow, please.
Yeah, I've got taken like scans of actors for like when I was working at some companies.
Yeah.
And like some of the women actors are just like, yeah, they were ex-models and they'd be like posing during the scanning process.
Right.
But, it doesn't work.
Yeah. But you do have the, I mean, so when you're doing your actual photo shoots, you do have different poses. You're experimenting with things.
Yeah. So like the first photo shoot where I'm just taking photos of like just the face and the texture, that's just them just sat there.
Right.
And it was just like blank face because I don't know what pose I'm going to do yet.
Right.
And I don't know lighting. So I just, it's just a basic, so I can get the proportions of the head shape and stuff like this.
Right.
And then, the lighting and stuff is like all changes.
Yeah. And then, once you have that reference, okay, so you know what you're doing. I obviously use the first portion of the photo shoot to start modeling and texturing and doing all this stuff. What do you start with at that point? Do you have like a basic mesh of a...
Yeah, so I've got this like generic human being, which is kind of rigged. So I can just... I'll just take a step back. So some of the like photos I have with like the lighting... It's like, even though it's like, I might like some of them, sometimes I just completely change it. So even though I wouldn't like copy it one for one for the photograph, sometimes I'll just like composite a whole bunch of different photographs together to make a good image. Like the portrait of Liz and Gabriel.
Right.
I just collaged like 15 different photographs to make that image.
Okay.
So I can just kind of use that as reference.
Yeah.
And then I'll go into Maya, pose my generic human being to the shape of like, that like that pose, and then I just go from there and just start sculpting and mudbox and start texturing and just start building it up. It's basically the same workflow as most character work,
right? And then, but you model everything, right? You model the clothes, you have stitches, and I've seen so much detail in the clothes.
Yeah, so I've not really got a chance. I've not had much chance to learn Marvelous Designer yet. So I find it easier just to sculpt clothes.
Right.
You just get like tension in clothes, like the tight clothes or loose clothes. Like every time I try to model clothes, you should be able to know what fabric it is just from the model. Without textures, you should still feel if it's a light cloth or like denim or something like that.
Right. Now, not necessarily knocking Marvelous Designer, which is a really good piece of software, but you mentioned something specifically about how you use technology in your stuff, right? That you don't necessarily use technology because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
You try to go ahead and tell the what you were we were talking about, like,
well, basically it's like I just whatever cheat I can do, I try not to deal with technology, basically.
Right.
Whatever artistic approach I could take, even if it's the incorrect way, if it works, I'll just do that.
Right. Because you find, but there's also something about finding the timelessness of the portrait, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, because it's like, I don't want you to look back in 5 years and be like, oh, this piece was done in 2018.
Right.
Because it's like, if that's the case, then it's like the technology is dictating what the artwork is.
Right.
So it's like, you should be like 100 years from now, look back and be like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like, I have no idea when this was created.
Right.
But in a way, it's almost impossible to avoid the technology in the work, I find. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, I guess, like looking back now, because it's like I want my work to represent our time. So I do people who I know today.
Right.
I won't do somebody who's like dead or somebody from this idea of what somebody might look like in the future. I always base everything on what today is, because I want my work to represent today.
Right.
And like the clothes they wear from people today.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if like the technology is a representation of what today is, at least people can look back and be like, oh, 2014, this is what the best technology is look like for this as well.
Right. Yeah, you're right. You can't avoid it. And let's go back to Rembrandt. There was a lot of technology that he used back then, which was, chemistry. Like he mixed his own paints.
Yeah. Like Leonardo, he invented oil paints.
Right.
So it's like you look back and be like, oh, that's when oil, like, it's part of his work.
Right.
He embraced it.
He was like a Vlado of his time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like basically it's like if I somehow can embrace it, maybe my work could stand out a little bit more or take the next level up.
Yeah.
But I've so much I've tried to avoid that as much as possible, but it's impossible. I can't. basically. That's just, but.
But you use the tools you can. And it's, you know, I've had the privilege of looking under the hood of some of your work, you know, yeah. like being able to go into the Miocene files, because I've used some of them to check out some different ideas of our own work and our own shaders and our own things and see how they would work on those types of portraits. And I'm 100% with you. Although you say you do it because you don't know technology and you're lazy or whatever, and you just find a hack to make it work. You actually do the right thing, maybe subconsciously.
Nice.
Even though you don't necessarily know much about shaders, or you don't really know how, you know, like the technology behind subsurface scattering and all those other things, you do exactly the right thing, which is just let it be the way it is. So many people feel the need to really make a super complex skin shader because they have some notion about something.
Yeah.
And there's no need for that.
No, not at all. It's so hard to make revisions too.
Right.
You know, you want to go back and there's like 20 texture maps for their face. You're like, well, I don't even know what's doing what anymore.
Right.
If it's just like you got just diffuse and spec, you're like, well, that's the diffuse and
that's the spec. Yeah. It's variable reduction is what I call it.
Yeah.
if you can keep the constants, you know, solid and reduce the amount of variables, then you're, yeah.
Yeah. I try to keep everything as simple as possible.
Right.
Like even the lighting is just like, with the portrait of Sean, it's just one rec light.
Right.
Like no texture attached to it.
Well, yeah, but that's completely valid, right? If you go to see a portrait from Rembrandt, as an example, he didn't have a bunch of LED lights around to write his portrait. He had a window.
Yeah, basically.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was the only light source coming through. Yeah, there's no absolutely. Need for millions of lights.
No, not at all. And there's something about the simplicity, which is like pleasing too. Like
right.
Aesthetically.
Yeah.
Like sometimes when, like detail's good, but detail should never overcome and overpower what you're trying to express.
But you do have detail. You have detail in modeling and textures.
Yeah, but I don't feel like it distracts you from what I'm trying to do. Like you don't look at it and be like, oh, wow, those pores are amazing. I want you to look back, oh, that's a cool portrait. And then secondary, oh, look at the pores. Those are cool.
Do you think that there's a macro and micro sort of idea of expression, right? Like there's the overall feeling that has to be at the same level as the detail, as you're saying, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can say it's like, yeah, micro or macro. Yeah, definitely. I think for me, it's like just the big things which I look for is just like silhouettes.
Okay.
Like contrast with the lighting. And then it's like every other detail is like a secondary thing for me. Like
the
pores, skin, like the clothes and stuff, that's just all secondary.
Yeah, those are the times when you just go, I'm going to go watch Netflix and just put stitches down, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay. And then let's talk a little bit about composition. Like what do you think about cameras and composition and lighting? Because I think those are our challenges as well.
Yeah. Well, most of like my portraits, people will say like, oh, why aren't, like you should make them move. But then it's like most of my portraits are made for 2D. Like imagery is supposed to look like a painting. So compositional lighting is actually, I'd say, is probably what I focus on the most.
Okay.
So as soon as it moves, it's like compositional lighting is completely out the window.
Right.
In a way. But I feel like so much can be expressed through how you light something. Like Rembrandt does everything in soft lighting and it makes his work feel warm.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Caravaggio, everything's hard, which makes it more like dynamic and like more aggressive in a way.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that have you ever done one that was much more hard? Because most of your stuff seems like to be very soft lighting at some point.
I'm not sure if I've done a really hard one yet.
Because the one I saw of that you were showing of, what's the, was the portrait of the girl who's cutting the throat of the guy. That was a pretty.
Oh, Artemisia Gentileschi?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of a.
That was pretty hard.
Yeah, it was.
But I think that
was it hard because it was so violent?
I think the lighting was hard on it too.
Yeah.
But that helped tell the story of the violence, right?
Yeah.
Because you need those hard lines. If it was nice and soft, it would be too soothing as she's slowly, not so slowly, slicing the throat of the guy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, like the most recent one, Portrait of Cassidy.
Yeah.
It was like everything was soft. So the soft lighting, the composition, there was no hard lines. The hair was just like kind of curved. Everything was in oval shapes.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just wanted nothing like lighting, composition, modeling, texturing. There was nothing hard about it.
Let's we'll put this podcast out after, because I know you said that was going to be on the cover of 3D World, right?
Yeah, that's what they told me.
So okay.
Hopefully, yeah.
So we'll put this out after that so that you can talk about it a little bit more and people can get some context for it.
Yeah, sounds good.
So the first thing that you mentioned is this was a commission piece, right?
Mm.
So you're starting to get commissions now to do these things.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Like my first commission was from Neil Blomkamp for his sister.
Yeah.
And then...
And why did he want that? He said, this is really cool. I'm going to commission you to do one.
Well, I did his brother and sister, the twins.
Right.
And then he was like, oh, my mom wants this one as well. And I get you to do this one because we can print them all out and put them on the wall. And I was like, yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
And then one of my friends was like, oh, can you do my daughter? I'll give you some money for that. And I'm like, sure.
How what's the challenge of doing a commission piece versus one that you want another one?
You have the worry that it's going to be like, they're going to give you revisions and be like, oh, I don't like this. This isn't what I want to pay for.
Right.
And then it's like, they're going to say like, oh, I want this. I want that. And they're like, no, like this is my work. This is my artwork.
Right.
You get what you're given,
right?
Kind of thing.
Is that, but have you gotten revisions?
No, not yet.
Yeah. I don't think anyone would dare.
No, I don't. Everyone, there's only been two commissions anyway. So
okay,
yeah, but maybe down the road I might. But so far, so good.
Yeah, I think that is very careful. But you also think there's a fear because one of the other things you mentioned is that you know, especially in the early portraits, these are people you're very familiar with, your family.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah.
So you know what your brother looks like. You know what both your brothers look like, and your sister-in-law, and your mother, and your dad, and I think they're fantastic, especially your mother and father it was really just kind of cool how you took them and you represented them in the way that you wanted to see them, right?
Yeah.
Your mother did not want it to be seen that way.
That's true. Yeah, I guess if it was a commission, like they'll be like, oh, I'm like better looking than this. And it'd be hard to be like, well, no, this is what you look like.
I think you mentioned a story, and maybe it was at THU, that your mother was not necessarily pleased with her portrait because you made her very serious.
Yeah, my mom's a very happy person.
Right.
So she's full of joy and happiness. And it's like I portrayed her very serious and like royalty in a way.
Right.
So she was like, I just look so miserable.
But I think that's kind of interesting because she said she looks miserable. But to me, and probably to you, she looks like she demands such ultimate respect because there's so much effort, you know?
That's what I was trying to portray, and that's what I wanted.
Right.
But then it's like, was it one of those occasions where I was controlling what the image was?
But that's right. Okay, so if you'd gone with her on vacation and she says, let's take a picture in front of the Louvre or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
She's not going to pose like that.
No, she wouldn't.
She would pose like a happy, lucky person, right?
Yeah, but that would be kind of a fake smile.
It would be a kind of a fake smile. Okay, good point. So do you think that she would expect a smile like that?
I'm not sure exactly. She probably just wanted to be like, capture a moment in a time where she's like a secret hidden camera, kind of camera. And then like that's probably what she wanted me to show.
Right.
Anyway, I was thinking, I was like, maybe that is the way I should capture people. Do like a candid camera, like a hidden one, so they don't even know about it. So they relax, and then I can just capture that moment.
But your dad, for example, right? Does your dad stand like that or sit like that?
No, I kind of wanted him to like. I wanted that more of a contemplative imagery for that. So
right.
I was like, Dad, pose like the thinker, or like put your hand on your chin, and like just
see
how you can go.
But that's what I'm getting at. It's like you're finding your. You're not necessarily posing them like your mother and your dad in the same way that they would feel natural. But what you're doing is you're saying, I see you in this way and I see you in the thinker, and you put them together.
Yeah. Yeah, so those actually, these are the portraits of my brothers, my family, like mom and dad. That's like my early series.
I know it's your early series, yeah.
So I think I try to control that a little bit more, whereas my more recent ones, it's like I have a little bit, I try to have control a little bit less.
Okay.
So like Tony and Cassidy is just like, Cassidy was so good behind the camera. She was so relaxed.
Awesome. How old is Cassidy?
16, I think.
Wow.
And then like after I stopped trying to control Tony was just a phenomenal, like he's just got that personality where it just shines. Uh-huh. So I was like, well, why am I telling him? He already knows he's got a great personality. Just let him take care of all this.
Well, he definitely feels like a really fun, chill guy. Like, you know what I mean? And that's the thing that's amazing is I've never met Tony.
Yeah.
I'd love to meet him. But just seeing, you know, that picture, I was like, I bet you I could have a beer with that guy.
You probably could. He loves beer.
Right. But I could tell, right? And the other thing you mentioned in your talk as well is how what was your talk with the guy from the actor about how your character is much more on the surface than you think it is.
Oh, Charles Copley.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was mentioning that we're not as deep individuals as we think we are. We think are like who we are is like deep, like soul. And it's like, but really it's like, if you change the color of your hair, you're going to act a lot differently because people are going to treat you differently. The clothes you wear, very like surface material stuff is actually going to change who you are.
Right.
So it's like, is the external self defining what the inner self is? We think it's always the inner self defining who the outer self is.
When I thought about that, I was like, well, that's a little shitty thing to say because like you say, people think there's more to their character.
Yeah.
But then I really started thinking about it after you said it on the talk, and this is the first time I think I heard you say it, is I was like, you know, I've seen like when I'm not feeling good or I want to, like I'm upset or disappointed in myself, I'll get a haircut.
Yeah.
You know?
Basically. Like if you want to
I want to feel more important. I'm going to wear a jacket today.
Yeah. You totally do a little bit.
And then that makes me feel more important.
I think that's true to a certain degree. But Charlotte Copley, he's an actor. So he
has to.
He's looking at this stuff. He's deciding how to mimic people. So he sees what he sees in the surface.
Right.
So he changes himself to match that. He doesn't need to match the internal, like deep individual. He just needs to match what he sees in the surface.
And he can see, I was like, I can see from the outside what that person is feeling. So I can just express that
outside. So from an acting point of view, I can totally see why he would say that.
Yes.
But I think we're a bit of a combo. I think we are deep in. I think there's a lot of surface stuff.
But there is, you can definitely read a lot of character from the outside.
Yeah, 100%.
Also, I think it's cultural. In Bulgaria, I can't really read a lot of character. They keep their emotions very tight.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's, you know, part of their culture and part of the way that they see things. And sometimes it's good to, you know, feel protective of your character and you don't necessarily express it on the outside. Sometimes, you know, we'll go to Italy, all their character is way on the outside.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
California, people might tend to be much more expressive and stuff. You know,
You get like very shy people who are like, they're kind of like, the body language is very like minimal. It doesn't move too much.
Uh-huh.
They're like the nicest people. And you're like, they have so much emotion.
Yeah.
But they hide it all inside.
They hide it all inside. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, like Vlado tends to, he's a very shy person. Right. And he's an amazing person. And every now and then when he's, something amazing happens, he has this just a little bit of smile and it's hard for him to like turn it off. You can tell he's almost fighting it,
He's
like, when I see it, I'm like, yes, he's excited. He's happy, you know? And I think that's a really good thing. And it's not necessarily that he's trying to hide it. It's just that he's shy really,
you know?
And he's a little bit more, introspective and very humble too, which I very much admire. Yeah, that's amazing. I really think I've learned so much from you over the last few years, and you know, I learned a lot from you without even speaking to you. Just by looking at your portrait, I was like, "There's something that's going on." I start to understand a few things, and then when we finally met, I started talking with you, and you started telling me a little bit about your inspiration. I was like, I was right. It's, you know, what's your inspiration is comes through just through your art. Like it's actually very obvious yeah. your point of view, right? You're yeah. not like, it's not like Jackson Pollock, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people will look at that art and say, eh, I don't know, anyone can do that, right? But then when you express it and you talked about the story of Jackson Pollock and why he did things.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you go ahead and tell the story.
So yeah, like I've had the debate with people about abstract art, and a lot of people just say the whole thing's terrible. And they it's like having a debate.
Well, I think a lot of artists wouldn't disagree, but.
But the thing is like, there is a lot of bad art out there. Mm-hmm. And I think what the difference.
Most of the art is bad, because otherwise if everyone did good art.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I think, okay, so what makes good art and what makes bad art? Good art is if it achieves the goal it's trying to create. So for a digital human, if we're trying to create a photorealistic human being and it doesn't look photorealistic, it falls short, it's not really that great. It's not really right. good art. So for Jackson Pollock's work, he wasn't trying to create representational work. He was trying to represent free thinking, free speech, just complete freedom of no control, no rules, no regulations.
And the context of that is that he was an artist during the Cold War.
That's right.
And so he was trying to contrast himself from what?
From Russia at the right. time. So the Russia had like control and rules and all those regulations. And he was like, no, I'm going to do the exact opposite.
Right.
So when his work came out, he was successful because he was showed the opposite of what we can be. And it's not what Russia was at the time.
Right.
And so when people saw this, they saw this idea and they loved it. And they think it was so great. But as like time goes on, we kind of like forget some of like the history. Like we know what all happened, but we kind of like aren't living. It's not present in the time.
Right.
So I don't think we can appreciate it as much as that generation could have.
Right.
So I think a lot of people like kind of misinterpret it and say, oh, it's like this, like I could do that.
Right.
But it's like you don't know what it was actually for or what the purpose was.
But you see that the point, well, maybe, and okay, so that brings up my point that I was looking at your work and I was like, as someone who's heavily obsessed with digital humans, yeah. as you know, I looked at your work and without having spoken to you, I understood the context of your work. I understood how your inspiration came from those artists. I understood what you were trying to do to an extent, right? I've learned more since actually speaking to you.
Yeah.
But it's not like you didn't have to go up to me and say, what I was really trying to do is I was inspired by Dutch masters. I love representation.
Yeah.
I took my family and I did this thing. You didn't have to tell me all of that. I could see it in your work on its own.
Yeah,
and maybe it's because of my particular position on digital humans and the time that we're dealing with where we have this struggle with digital humans.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw all of that. So I think that succeeded. And probably the same way that you looked at Pollock, you know, if you went back to the 1960s and you go like, oh, yeah, now I get it.
If I had to explain to you I'm doing digital humans and you looked at my portrait, obviously it would be a terrible portrait.
Do you think some people look at that and say, I don't understand. I don't understand what he's doing. He's taking photos of people and then modeling them. Do you think people say that?
Yeah, some people think it's just photographs. But I think it's just not knowing what the technology is.
Right.
I think because technology we're doing is so new. So that's like why breakdowns kind of help, like gray models and like just, we're like the first generation who's actually had to do breakdowns in history before, which I think is kind of interesting because Rembrandt would obviously never do a breakdown of his painting.
So, but time lapse of his painting. You have to paint a painting of him doing a painting over time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And why do you feel, why do you think we feel compelled to do breakdowns just to prove something or to show people what it's like?
I think it's just so people can kind of understand what they're looking at. And I think it's also to get some recognition because I think a lot of people, I've had it a lot where people say, wow, technology these days.
Yeah.
And it's like, the computer didn't do this. Like the programmers, they're artists.
Right.
And the like writers and like, those are the people, like the human mind is the artist. The computer's a tool.
Right.
But it's like most people give the computer the credit.
I hate that.
Which is kind of frustrating. So as long as you show some breakdowns, it's like it pulls back some recognition for yourself.
Do you think that's a problem? Because I've been talking about it for a long time, especially in the film industry, in visual effects, how a lot of people are like, oh, it's all CG and therefore it's bad. And I hate that, especially the popular press and all the other stuff. They just, if a movie's not good,
yeah.
right? If a movie's not good because it's a bad story,
yeah.
but the CG is good, really good. They will blame the lack of success of the film because they'll say it was done with CG and they should have done it practical.
Yeah, that's true. That's always quite frustrating.
It is frustrating. And they say it's all computers now. And no. How long did it take you to...
There's more artists now working on films than there was ever before.
Right.
But they're saying, no, they're not saying that. They're saying it's, oh, more computers.
Right.
It's like, no, it's more artists.
Just look at the credits.
Yeah.
How many of those people, yeah, they're all artists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite impressive how many artists are working on something to, yeah, make something happen now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is, it is. I think it's really important that people recognize the importance of the artist's role in digital work.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so you make the breakdowns and stuff. Let's see, where was I going to go with that? I don't remember, but
me neither.
It's the end of the conference, so I'm like kind of burned out.
Yeah, I burnt out from the talk I just gave.
Yeah,
it was like I was on full like 100% energy level, and I was just like, oh, that's going to worn out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the roles that some of the things that, you know, I asked you to sort of be part of the Digital Human group and sort of help out on some of those ideas and things of that nature. What do you think about the idea of what, you know, the Wiki Human project and how that is? What are some of your thoughts on that?
I think it's like pretty cool to see. It's like you're trying to create like a standard for digital humans. I mean, like, I feel like there's a lot of the technical stuff you're trying to like get out the way and be like, this is accurate skin, this is accurate, like whatever, like lighting. So you're getting rid of all the technical stuff. So
yeah,
we have a realistic representation of what a human being is.
Yeah.
So the artist can take that and then like take that information, use what they want to use from it, and also add their own artistic talent into it, which,
sure,
will make it less photorealistic, but it'll create it more like an art piece.
Well, they could make it just as photorealistic. It's not far from what you did, right? Because,
yeah,
you meant, he's like, I don't know, I just use a very simple shader, et cetera, et cetera. Now, it happens to be also pretty close to accurate what you're,
yeah,
doing, okay? You just don't necessarily realize that. But if I can give a saying and say, do not, you should keep this as, these are the constants that you can swear by,
right? Yeah.
These are good constants. And they may evolve, they may get better, and that technology can prove what that is, and we will continue to update those the model. But giving that back to the artist, my goal is, if I can go to, let's say someone wants to be another great digital artist, right?
Yeah.
And wants to work on the digital human stuff and is inspired by you, but doesn't even know where to start.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I can basically say, this is a scanned human, completely real. There are artists who have worked on this, and there's a little bit of interpretation, mostly in areas where the scan was failed or couldn't quite get,
yeah,
the detail, right? Like around the connection between the eyes and the eyelids. Those are the challenging parts right now we have, especially since they're two different scans. But we can say, this is where you start. Then they can look at their own, like, I'm going to make another digital human.
Yeah.
I'm going to represent that. And I know, well, I already have a shader that I know is exactly correct.
Yeah.
I don't have to change it. And I already have a representation of exactly what the diffuse map needs to look like.
Yeah.
Exactly what the spec map needs to look like. And I know how detailed I need to make the skin because I have an exact representation of the displacement map.
Yeah. No, it's pretty good. And it's like you're allowing the artist to be the artist.
Yeah.
They don't have to be like a scientist. They can, yeah, just go straight into the artwork.
Do you think that some artists, and I'm going to almost use air quotes here, artists get distracted by the science, and sometimes they just get, oh, I'm going to go to this really complicated science and I'm really exploring things, and the science distracts them from being an artist?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I find myself getting caught up in some of the science, like, because it's like, you don't, like, the science, it's like sometimes like, oh, I got to learn, like I just learned XGen.
Right.
And it took me a month to actually feel comfortable with it. But I feel like it took a couple of steps back just having to learn the technology side. and I was completely distracted
right.
from the artistic, like the composition and lighting and like the emotion I was trying to portray.
Okay.
So for that month, I was just put my artistic mind on hold
okay.
while I just focused on the science. Because you can't do one without the other. You do need a bit of the science to go with it. But for me personally, I just don't want to deal with that side.
Right.
And so it was like literally Human League giving me those answers.
But did it, so in the easier. End, it saved you time, possibly?
Did it? Me learning like X-Gen?
No, but when actually executing the hair for the portrait.
Yeah, the whole portrait took a little bit longer because I had to do that learning process.
Right.
But if I take anything of Digital Human League, like any of the skin stuff they've done,
right.
and I just edit, that saves me tons of time.
Right.
So it's like if somebody else can just do the technical stuff, I absolutely love it.
But now that you've learned it and it took you time to learn that hair, right? The next time you do hair, will you use X-Gen to do it?
Yeah, probably.
And then would that save you time ultimately?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. So technology is there, like, okay, you suffered through that moment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then once you do that, it's like, okay, now I can go better on this.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still, I'd still rather somebody else just tell me what it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. I'm not necessarily knocking it. I want to say that people shouldn't be distracted by technology, because I definitely see, even a conference like this, there's some guys out there that love it, right?
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, they were trying to do something or talk to some guys who were doing some Archivist stuff, and they had to do this thing on a beach, and they're like, we're going to learn fluid sims, we're going to make a beach, we're going to do the foam on the water, and it's going to be all physically based. And like, that's a huge learning curve, you know, especially from an architect.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I can actually see the fun in it, though. Like,
sure.
Like when I was in high school, like doing math, and it's like you finally figure out the problem with that. It's quite satisfying.
Sure.
You got a puzzle and you're trying to solve like a Rubik's Cube and you solve it.
Yeah.
It's pretty satisfying.
Yeah.
And it's like you have a rig. You finally rigged it. There's like this beautiful blend shape of like the face or something. You're like, oh, nice. I did it. It feels, there's a satisfaction in it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit. So, what's happened since THU? THU was the first time you sort of talked about your work publicly.
Yeah.
And that was back in September.
That's right.
So we're looking at about 6 months, a little over 6 months later. How's things changed since then? Have you talked more publicly about things?
A little bit. I did a little presentation on Oats in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Chris Harvey, we just got up on stage and just talked about what we did at Oats and the future of Oats. So that was kind of got me out of my shell a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
I've just done some like online interviews and stuff.
Done more online interviews.
Yeah. Not too many or anything.
Do you feel you're starting to get more recognition for your work? And
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
Because I know that when we put the Tony image that you did and we put it up on social media, it exploded.
I wasn't expecting that. People seemed to like it.
Yeah.
Which was quite nice.
And I know that when the Cassidy one goes public, it's going to explode.
Hopefully.
Because it's gorgeous. It's really gorgeous. It's a pretty impressive what you did. And it's interesting that you learned something new about it and did some few things. And the learning process is not just about like, you know, using X-Gen or some new thing or whatever. It's about like you learn how to make people relax, or you learn, you know, the order of which to take your photographs. There's always something you can learn, right?
I feel like, yeah, even like you always want to progress. Like even like my public speaking from THU to like, each portrait is kind of like a next step in my life. And it's just like, I wanted to develop me as a human being. So if it takes me to like another interview, it's like, I feel like I should say yes to it, because it's like, I'm so like, I don't want to be behind the camera. I don't want to be on stage, but by doing it develops me as a human being.
Yeah.
And each portrait, I feel like that's the same idea. Like I learned so much about myself through each portrait.
Right.
So each portrait is like a step up in like me figuring out who I am as well.
Do you think also the fact that you put some of your ideas into words, that you have to make a logical sense about things, allows you to say, oh, yeah, I've been thinking this kind of, but I never really put it into words, that sort of helps you a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. And you're going back to THU again, right?
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. So it's going to be in Malta. I'm excited about that.
I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty awesome. But what have you thought of, Sofia so far?
It's amazing. I really like it so far.
Yeah.
So I've only really been like this event so far.
Right.
So we got that tour tomorrow morning of like downtown. So
oh, you haven't even been downtown yet, right?
No, not yet.
Oh, so yeah, it's nice down morning. There.
I asked to stay an extra day because they originally booked me to leave before the tour. And I was like, no, let me stay another day.
Yeah, you need to see Sofia.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, the event's been pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, dinner last night was pretty fun with the dancing.
Yeah, it was.
It was pretty good. It was a lot of fun. I'm actually just kind of blown away by the event. It was kind of, they did, even though I work for the company, they exceeded my expectations in terms of how good they organized this. It's a really good job.
Yeah. And you were dancing last night in the restaurant?
I was dancing a little bit in a restaurant. They were doing Bulgarian folklore dancing, and they gathered people from the stage to join them in Bulgarian folklore, and I was involved in some of that. That's true. It was fun. And the food is really good. So
yeah, it was delicious.
Yeah. So listen, I don't want to take up too much more of your time because there's actually a social event going, and I want to make sure you have the ability to go to that social event right
now.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for doing this podcast. And you know, you're welcome to do it anytime.
Thanks for having me.
And I remember the first time we chatted.
Yeah, there was no way I was ever going to do this.
No. See, you've evolved as a person, right?
Exactly. Yeah. All these talks.
And I said, what it was is we were going to do an interview with you for the website.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a written interview, right?
Yeah.
But I hate doing that typing questions, getting an answer, typing questions, getting an answer.
Yeah, totally makes
sense. So I said, well, let's just talk. We'll record it and then we'll have Henry make it into a blog post. And you said, wait, you're going to record it? This isn't going to be one of your podcasts, is it? No. It's just a conversation. But I could have totally made that a podcast and just secretly told you, by the way, it's a podcast now.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was good. All right, Ian, thanks so much. And it's always a pleasure seeing you. I'm always excited for you to be around. Your talk was, I think Phil Miller, who's one of the guys who we work with at Chaos Group, he looked at me. He said, "Oh my God, that's like a TED talk." I said, "Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
That's good.
Really good." All right, thanks, Ian.
All right, thanks a lot.